So last summer, I introduced or maybe reintroduced to you J.D. Salinger's short novel called Franny and Zoe. Franny and Zoe are brother and sister. It's set in 1950s New England. Franny is a college student, and she's very much like J.D. Salinger's other famous character, Holden Caulfield, in Catcher in the Rye. She's inward, she's very introspective, and she's very exasperated with the way of things. She's just so very tired of the fact that she seems, that the whole world seems to be blighted with a universal superficiality. And as she's having lunch with her boyfriend, she continues to just lament how much pretense there is in the world, which is sort of ironic because she finds her boyfriend to be the epitome of pretense. But she just sort of languishes in that realization that the world is just what it ought not be. But then later in the novel, she is declaring that same sentiment to her brother. And she says, which is on the front of your bulletin, "I don't think you would have all got me quite so down if just once in a while, just once in a while, there was at least some polite, little, perfunctory implication that knowledge should lead to wisdom, and that if it doesn't, it's just a disgusting waste of time. But there never is. You never even hear any hints dropped on a campus that wisdom is supposed to be the goal of knowledge. You hardly ever even hear the word wisdom mentioned." Franny is exhibiting, with all respect to the college students and postgrads in the room, she is exhibiting that sort of familiar idealism that comes out when you're in college or you're in grad school. And yet, at the same time I say that, she is echoing nothing less than what Job says. On the top of the inside of your bulletin, Job says in chapter 28, "Where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it's not found in the land of the living." He, too, is expressing the same exasperation of the absence of wisdom in the world. It's so needy. It's no needed. And yet, it proves so elusive. For the next 7 weeks, all the way until Lent, we're going to consider, what is this wisdom that both Franny and Job are both desirous to see? There's an irony to Franny's search, though. She's pining for wisdom, and she ends up finding some of it in an extended conversation with her brother. And her brother's name happens to be Zoe. And for all of you Greek students in the room, you know what the word Zoe means in Greek. It means life. And it's the Proverbs that tell us that in wisdom we find our life. She's pining for wisdom, and she finds it by taking refuge in the one whose name is life. What an irony. I don't know if Salinger intended it or not. For that reason, we're going to turn our attention to what this wisdom is and what the Proverbs are trying to tell us about wisdom, how not only is wisdom to be regarded, but how it's to be found in what we're going to find in the Proverbs. And by way of introduction from chapter 1, we're going to note three things about wisdom today: the purpose of it, the necessity of it, and the key to its benefit. What is the purpose of wisdom? What is the necessity of wisdom? And what is the key to its benefit? So, if you'll stand, we're in Proverbs chapter 1, the first 19 verses. Proverbs chapter 1, starting in verse 1. The proverb of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel: "To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Hear, my son, your father's instruction. Forsake not your mother's teaching. They are a graceful garland for your head and pendants for your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, don't consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood, let us ambush the innocent without reason, like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole, like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods, we shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us, we will all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Hold back your foot from their paths, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird, but these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. For those not familiar with the Proverbs, they are part of the genre of Scripture called wisdom, for good reason. Other books that share that same features and characteristics are the book of Job, the book of Ecclesiastes, the book of Song of Solomon. If you've never read the Proverbs are often short, pithy sayings that usually invoke very vivid analogies to bring attention to substantive life issues. They're attributed traditionally mostly to King Solomon. They've likely been culled from a variety of sources and compiled, but the setting that might be best to understand in which they're given is the setting of a father to his son. You heard in the text of, hear these words, my son, do not let them depart from you. These are the kinds of things that a father and a mother want their kid to know before they go off to college. Or to borrow a Middle Earth analogy, this is kind of like how Gandalf thinks of Bilbo. This is the kinds of things that he wants to say to him before he goes off as a small thing in a wide, wide world. The purpose of the Proverbs is to lead us to a maturity, to lead us to life. In verses 1 through 6, it rattles off a series of purposes for the compilation. But then in verse 4, it summarizes that purpose when it says, the Proverbs are there to give prudence to the simple. That is, to lead anyone who hears them to maturity. Maturity, therefore, correlates to the obtaining of wisdom. So what does that mean? What does it mean to mature in wisdom? It first of all means to grow in a sense of it. In verse 2, it says, to know wisdom, to understand words of instruction. Whenever the Bible uses the word to know, it's not in the cool, detached, dispassionate way that you and I typically associate with the word knowledge, that you file away and factor things and you come back to them for later use. This kind of knowing that the Bible speaks of is an intimate acquaintance with something. It is at the fingertips. It is deeply felt. It is deeply realized. It's more than just possessing knowledge. It's an application of that knowledge. One is not content with simply amassing facts. One only knows something until they're practicing it. It's the difference between sitting in first-year anatomy class in med school and being the guy that has to treat the patients during the residency. That's the difference in having certain head knowledge and actually applying it. It's a qualitative difference between those kinds of knowledge. It's the difference, if I might put it in another context, it's the difference between a recent graduate of seminary quoting Romans 8:28 as he sits at the bedside of a couple whose wife is about to deliver a stillborn child at 10 weeks, and a person who sits at the bedside and simply weeps with them and in that moment confirms the truth of Romans 8:28 without ever having to say it. That's a qualitative difference in the understanding of what the truth is, and it comes through application. And therefore, having a sense of wisdom is not just applying a principle. It's applying it in a timely way. There are children in my household who like to become law enforcement for one another from time to time. They will like to invoke certain principles that they've heard us articulate at different moments when they see the other one acting up. Mom, you don't like to listen to whining, do you? You know, they're saying things like that. Or they'll say, Daddy, one doesn't get dessert unless one helps out with cleaning up, right? You know, they bring up all these principles sort of out of nowhere for their own purposes, their own agenda. And they are invoking truth in some sense. They are invoking right principles, but they're not taking into consideration other extenuating circumstances that might have to force them to nuance their application of the truth. They have to realize that sometimes one of their siblings' behavior is stemming from the fact that they skipped lunch or they missed a nap. And therefore, the application of the principle has to be tailored to the moment. That's wisdom. Wisdom means doing the right thing. It means doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. And therefore, that means maturity is having a sense of what wisdom is. But it also means having a receptivity to wisdom. In verse 3, it says, "The Proverbs were collected that we might receive instruction." That is, that we might be willing to listen out for it, that we might be willing to submit to it when we hear it. Throughout the Proverbs, we're going to hear what characterizes a fool is primarily someone who is unwilling to listen to instruction, who is so confident in their understanding that they will not admit any other data. This receptivity means willing to be listened for wisdom when you're young. And it also means being willing to listen to wisdom when you're old. Verse 5, it almost is a break in the litany of the purposes of the Proverbs when it says, "Let the wise hear and increase in learning. Let the one who understands obtain guidance." Now, wait a minute. If I understand, if I'm already wise, why should I listen further? Because one doesn't ever graduate from the school of wisdom. It is a class that is always in session. It is a class to which we must always apply ourselves. And so that receptivity implies a certain humility if you're going to be the one to understand the purpose of wisdom, and therefore it means acquiring an ear for it. Verse 6 makes this very paradoxical comment when it says, "We are given wisdom that we might be able to understand wisdom." They present a challenge to those who listen to them. Their meaning is not immediately evident. The point that they make often requires patience and thoughtfulness and contemplation, which means you can't consider what the Proverbs are saying while you're multitasking. They require a greater attention if you're ever to draw out the meaning from them. I was once in the presence of someone who I found out to have been at one time a military interrogation officer. And the way I came to know of their vocation is that they were wearing a t-shirt. And upon that t-shirt was emblazoned this simple phrase: "Never believe a first report, never trust a source." And I asked him, "What is that all about?" And then he told me his vocation. And what he was saying is, the first report of a situation is usually the least reliable. Just turn on the internet. Right? To believe a single source without corroborating it with other sources would always be an error in judgment, according to his experience. In war, he had come to learn that to ascertain the truth of a situation required a patient analysis of all the data that you could get. You couldn't have it all, but you could wait for more, that you might make a more reasonable discernment. He had cultivated an ear for truth by realizing that truth tended to emerge more progressively. We sit with the Proverbs so that we can learn an undistracted, patient posture. I have a lot of musicians in the room, and so you're familiar with the idea of perfect pitch, and you realize that perfect pitch, I'm told, comes at first by listening to one note over and over and over and over and over again until you can almost hear it without hearing it, because you notice features and characteristics of the sound that become so familiar to you that then when you hear it in octaves, you realize, ah, that's a C. And then when you learn intervals, you realize, ah, that's just three notes up from C. That's how you begin to learn this idea of perfect pitch. If you're in the Secret Service and you want to learn what are counterfeit bills, you don't learn it by studying the fake. You learn it by studying the genuine article. That's like wisdom. You accustom yourself to wisdom by hearing what wisdom is over and over again, by putting it into practice, by praying through it. That's how you discover and acquire an ear for wisdom. That's its purpose, so that you might become mature. Now, all that is so wonderfully and yet regrettably abstract. Great. Proverbs leads to maturity. So what? You and I tend to reduce our lives to a series of attainments. We got to get the degree. Maybe we want to find a spouse. Maybe we want to get a promotion. Maybe we want to secure a retirement. We're all about meeting the next milestone, reaching the next accomplishment. And there's nothing wrong with aspiring to things like that, to be sure. The problem with that approach to life is that even if you get all things, all those things, you can be a degreed idiot. You can be a married lecher. You can be an invested fool. You can aim for those things, but unless your overarching aim is the wisdom of God, then you are going to fall into the same predicament that Franny is bemoaning in her novel. Being a knowledgeable person that has no wisdom. The Proverbs have a far more valuable aim that yields a better return, and that's maturity. Why is maturity better than all those attainments? Because the human heart is tempted to seek so much from them, to depend too much on them, and maturity recognizes what those attainments really are. They don't define you. They don't stabilize you. They're just aspects of your story. Maturity is a contentment with them as it is a contentment without them. And that's why we seek the wisdom that leads to maturity. That's the first plank of the case for the Proverbs. Why do we listen to them? Because their purpose leads us to a maturity. Second point. Why are they necessary? Why are they not just a good idea? Why are they essential to life? I asked my kids yesterday, all right, what's wisdom? Well, it's knowing the right thing. All right, but how is that different from knowledge? Well, it's knowing to do the right thing in the right time. Okay, but why do we need it? Why do we need wisdom? And they said, for living. You don't have it, you don't live. There's an essentiality to it that we have to incline ourselves to if we're to receive it. And so that's why in verses 8 and 9, it continues this homage to the instruction that leads to wisdom. And it uses these wonderful metaphors. It talks about wisdom being like a garland. A garland in that context was referring as a metaphor to real achievement. You put a garland upon your head when you won the race. The pendants that you might wear in that day would give an air of distinction and attractiveness. And that's all to say that there is with wisdom an attractiveness and a glory to it. And it's something that people notice. And then the remainder of this text presents a very stark image by way of a narrative. It speaks of conniving men out of gain, out for gain at the expense of innocence. They invite others to participate in their scheme. They promise bountiful gain to anybody who will partner with them. And all of that puts forth an apparent wisdom, a wisdom that allows them to hatch and execute and fulfill a plan. But in that apparent wisdom, it's actually underlined full of folly. And so the proverbialist here, he compares them to hunters who lay out their nets in the sight of the birds that they're trying to catch. Now, I'm no hunter, but I'm guessing that on a duck hunt, you don't wear bright orange. And you don't blast your portable radio from the duck blind. That those are counterproductive to your effort. Their folly, the folly in the last part of our passage here, lies in the fact that these men have set traps for themselves that they thought were going to trap others. They lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. They're out for gain, but they suffer loss. Why? Because it's without the wisdom of God that teaches a respect for righteousness, justice, and equity. Their designs are sinful. They're called sinners because they lack true wisdom. And so the story is meant as a warning. And what that warning is this. The necessity for the Proverbs stems from the deceitfulness of sin. It's why we need them. Despite the caricature-like quality of the story, its point is relevant in this fact. It is a story, but their story is a pattern for every sin, yours and mine. How do I mean? At the bottom of every sin is a promise of gain. No one ever sins because they think it's going to cost them. They sin because they think they're going to get something by it. Adam and Eve, they choose to sin because they believe that by partaking of the tree that would not lead to loss, it would mean to their gain. They would become like gods without needing to defer to the God who gave them everything else they needed. To commit adultery, you have to believe that you're going to get something better from the one who is not your spouse than the one who is. To neglect your wife and children for the sake of your career, you have to believe that the money, the prestige, the power, the sense of identity, that all of that is better than what you might get from being a father or a mother. To use all your money, your time, your resources for your own sake, rather than give a portion of yourself to the ministry of His church, is to believe that there is greater gain to holding on what you have than to giving any of it away. Lust, greed, avarice, all those things that people have come to know as the seven deadly sins, all of them make a promise of gain. But they all end up setting a trap for you, and they mean loss. If our aim is the wisdom of God, we need the Proverbs because we're so easily duped into the deceitfulness of sin. Something has to refute the argument of the promise of sin. Something has to preempt our giving it a second thought. That's why we need it. That's why we need wisdom. But in a sense, Franny's complaint still stands, even if we come to terms with both the purpose and the necessity of wisdom. In a world full of smart, knowledgeable people, wisdom is still not prevailing. For all of its benefit, why aren't more of us practicing it? My last point comes from one very brief comment in verse 7, where it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction." What is the key to the benefit of wisdom? It's the fear of the Lord, which you're going to hear over and over and over again as you read through the Proverbs. So what is that fear? It's an enigmatic phrase on the face of it. It shows up so often in the Proverbs that we just can't leave it alone. So let's unpack it briefly. What is it? In one sense, fear means fear. There are reasons to be terrified of the Lord. His promises to those who oppose Him are fearsome. His power is great. His judgments are ferocious. But this fear is not a raw terror, a terror that makes you want to run and hide. That's not the fear of which the proverbialist is speaking. There's too much rejoicing and delighting in the wisdom of God to think that this fear of Him means we want to avoid Him at all costs. It's not that. So fear means fear, but it also means something richer and deeper. It's a profound awe at His transcendence. It is in some sense beholding His beauty and being diminished and dismantled by it. An awe that leads you not to want to trifle with Him. But it's an awe of appreciation and adulation. You're so terrified of messing with Him that you would not dare be separated from Him. John Calvin said early in his Institutes, he said this of the fear of the Lord: "It's the wisdom that restrains itself from sinning, not out of dread of punishment alone, but because it loves and reveres God as Father. Even if there were no hell, it would still shudder at offending Him." That's the fear of the Lord. I've used this illustration before, and maybe even recently, but the closest thing I can think of as a comparison to the fear of the Lord is about what it must mean to be near a rocket launch. When Orion went up on December 4th, I was transfixed. That's my thing. I dig that a lot. I wish I could be present to an actual launch someday. Bucket list. You get too close to Orion on its launch, you are going to be incinerated. But you understand it. When you understand it, you want to be near it enough to be able to see it, to feel it, to smell it. You don't want to avoid it. But there's an amazement that comes with understanding your smallness in comparison to it. That's fear of the Lord, I think. Augustine said it's that kind of fear that militates against human pride. We're not led to cower, but we only see ourselves as we really are, created and contingent amid a God who is neither of those things. That's a rough explanation of what the fear of the Lord is, but why is it so foundational to true wisdom? I'll give you two reasons. The first is that fear sustains your motivation to abide in wisdom. If you start picking up the Proverbs tomorrow and you start reading through it, at some point you're going to say, I can never do that. These are too hard. The bar is too high. What it asks of your heart, of your tongue, of your resources, of your decision-making process, and a lot of times it's going to feel very counterintuitive, and a lot of times it's going to feel very countercultural. And whatever promise it makes is sometimes slow in the coming. And so it's only by a fear of the Lord, which we might otherwise call trust, that we're going to find our reason to stick with what they ask of us. A fear of the Lord grounds the authority of the Proverbs and sustains your motivation in them. But they also, secondly, it's in the fear of the Lord that keeps you honest in what really motivates your obedience. And here's where we all have a spiritual gut check. Some of you have already done what the Proverbs have asked, and you've done it for decades. And whatever promise of reward that the Proverbs asked didn't materialize. These aren't formulae. If you do this, then this will necessarily happen with 100% notice. You may have done everything you knew to bring up your children in the admonition of the Lord, and they may still be so estranged, you don't know what to do next. You did all you knew to honor and respect the spouse of your youth, and they still may have cheated. You might have sought to live above board with everybody in your dealings with others, and they may have still defrauded you. What then? What do you do with wisdom then? Do we discard their authority? Do we discard our faith? Or do we circle back to what the Proverbs say about the fear of the Lord being the beginning and the foundation of all wisdom? See, it's in living with the right fear of Him that we see that what has to motivate our obedience is Him and Him alone. We don't obey primarily to get what the obedience promises. We obey because we love Him. We obey because we want to know that the greatest satisfaction that we might have is just in knowing that this is what pleases Him. That's the heart He wants from us. That's the heart He intends for us. The Proverbs are not chemical reactions that if you add this and this and this, you'll get this. They're lived-out expressions of what it means to love the one who authored them. They do oftentimes yield goodness, but they will always yield satisfaction to those who do them for God's honor alone. And so as you and I walk through the Proverbs over these next several weeks, and you bump into the sayings which you have followed, but which did not yield that promise, it's in that moment that you're going to have to ask yourself, were you doing it for Him or for you? If the Lord is great and greatly to be praised, then true wisdom is seeking to do His will for no other reason than that God calls it for us. That's a fear of the Lord. And if right now you're feeling, I cannot possibly live like that, I'm going to need something in return if I'm going to keep keeping on with the Proverbs. If that's what you're thinking, you're absolutely right. You can't do it. I can't just tell you, have the fear of the Lord and then do the Proverbs with consistency. It's not going to be by sheer force of will that you're going to be able to follow its command. So what will allow you to stay in the fear of the Lord that you might follow Him into wisdom and maturity? It's this. You come to the fear of the Lord by looking at Jesus. That right and proper fear comes to you when you look to the one who Luke says grew in wisdom and in stature, who was the innocent one ambushed without good reason, who was swallowed up by death only to swallow up the very ones who sent him there and forgive them in the process. When you come to this table and the cross to which it points, you see what forms the fear of the Lord perfectly. You see where the wisdom of the Lord is most manifest, because it's here where God satisfies both his commitment to justice and holiness and his commitment to mercy and love. It's here. It's what you're about to partake of. It's what you're about to become in fellowship with if you're in him. The Venerable Bede, many centuries ago, made a distinction between a servile fear and a friendly fear. A servile fear refuses to disobey because they're afraid of punishment, but a friendly fear refuses to disobey out of fear of offending the one you love. We all start in this life with a servile fear, but we all mature into this friendly fear. And what will help us most mature is to know we are loved by the one who died for us and called us friends. So for the next 7 weeks, what am I asking you to do? To every once in a while in your day, turn everything off and sit down with the Proverbs. To listen to what they say and consider why they are considering themselves wisdom. To put into practice that which they declare. And then when the cost of doing them seems excessive, to consider the cost of the God who brought you to himself and in whose so doing manifested his wisdom in most perfection. It's then, when you look at what the Lord has done for you in Christ, that you find what is the path of wisdom. It's then that you find that you'll be destined for maturity, and it's then that you'll be taking refuge in Zoe, in life. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.